Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. The University of South Dakota School of Education is hosting professional development workshops this week, and the topic is culturally responsive teaching. Renowned scholar Dr. Geneva Gay will begin with a keynote speech this Wednesday, June 8th at 6 p.m. in Vermilion. I am joined in the studio now by Dr. Donald Easton Brooks. He is the Dean of the School of Education. We're going to talk about the need for culturally responsive education in South Dakota and the impact it can have. Dr. Easton Brooks, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you much, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with an overview of how we should consider culturally responsive education for people who haven't heard that term.
Sure. So oftentimes people might hear culturally competent or culturally responsive and, you know, really try to make sense of what that means. And I think one of the things that we want to work through this workshop is really talk about culturally responsive teaching and what that's about in culturally responsive education. So when you think about culturally competent, it suggests that you have to have a competency about a culture, which can make it very challenging, for instance, for me to understand and be competent about what it means to be a woman. That's a very difficult thing for me to do, no matter how open I might be to things that women might face. That's a challenge for me. When we think about people, for instance, African Americans, there are over 20 different subgroups of African Americans in the United States, from Cuban African, from Spanish African, from people who might have grown up in the Northwest versus the South versus the Northeast. And those cultures might have different competencies based on where they're from and those experiences, those historical experiences. And so to ask someone who's not of that culture to be competent is asking a lot, and it can become kind of confusing. And so what we really try to talk about is being culturally responsive. Let me sit back for a minute. For me to be culturally competent about my culture is something that I should strive for. Are you about your culture, whatever those cultures might be, to really understand your culture and what that means to you. But when we talk about culture responsiveness, it's about how do we respond to other cultures? How do we respond to the culture of poverty, the culture of gender, the culture of race, the culture of family structure, and these different cultures that we might have? And that doesn't mean that we have to understand it all, but be responsive to what someone might bring into that culture, that, for instance, to the classroom, that might impact their ability to learn and develop. So
is this a newer concept? Is this something that's been around for a few decades and we're just starting to talk about it more and more?
Exactly. It's been around for a few decades. Actually, Dr. Gay is on our second edition of this book. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we're really trying to talk about more and more, especially in our state, given that our state is starting to change as far as its diversity. For instance, you think about Sioux Falls and some of the things that they're facing with the culture of poverty and what that means to learners in their classroom. Think about the culture of the Native population, or the African-American population has doubled now in the state of South Dakota, the Spanish-speaking population. And so as we think about those different populations, how are we responding to those populations in the way that we can provide an education that's meaningful, that's collective?
Are you hearing from teachers a request for insight into that, or is it something that you're kind of sought out on your own and trying to convince teachers that it's valuable use of their time?
Sure. On my first year here in the state, I have had an opportunity to meet a lot of supers, principals, and teachers, and this is one of the things that they've talked about. How do we engage in a way that is meaningful? How do we engage with our diverse populations in a way that's more meaningful? Mm-hmm. And so this is something that, because of the conversations, I thought, okay, here's something that we can do as a university to really help our community as a whole, and also set up a foundation for how we talk about this as a state, common language, common kind of views of how we move forward together and work with our diverse populations.
What's the gap? I mean, what's the risks of not addressing it all? What's happening to students who are in the non-dominant culture in a classroom?
Sure.
And by dominant, I don't mean that they're being dominated necessarily, but
I know what you mean.
They're
right.
In the minority
right.
In that classroom.
Exactly. I know what you mean. And so some of the things that come to play, and a lot of the recent research has talked about, those students who are in classrooms in which cultural responsiveness is not addressed. Let me take that back. Where cultural responsiveness is addressed, tend to do better than those students of color, students of poverty, that are in communities where cultural responsiveness is not addressed. And so what that means is that as students go into the classroom, they do feel themselves separate than other students in the classroom, because they don't feel like their culture is something that's respected or represented. And you think about the culture of poverty, some of the things we ask students to do or bring to the classroom, and students who are in poverty that don't have the money to bring that into the classroom, bring whatever it might be into the classroom, might feel isolated, might feel embarrassed, might feel like they are not part of society as a whole. So how do we kind of talk about narrowing those gaps in which we talk about this conversation so that they do feel more confident? What we do find with school-aged children, there are two things that they really kind of make sense to them. One is this feeling of identity. Do I belong? Do I fit? Do I feel comfortable? And when they don't feel those things, they do one or two things. They act out or they retreat within themselves. And so they are not focused on learning because they're focused on, I am different, and because I'm different, I can't achieve.
They're focused on surviving.
Surviving, exactly. And so as we talk more with teachers about what this means to help students feel engaged, I think these students will feel better, feel more comfortable in the classroom. And even the ways in which we talk about things in a classroom, how comfortable are teachers in talking about those type of experiences? For instance, there's an experience that I've heard of here in the state in which a teacher wanted to show a movie that was a historical movie that might have had some suggestive words in it, N-word, et cetera, in it. And the teacher, after talking to a couple of students of color, felt discouraged on showing the film rather than stepping back and say, how do we have this conversation? Because it is a part of our history, but how do we have this conversation as far as a historical piece and moving forward, not from a sense of, you know, feeling uncomfortable to talk about it? And it doesn't mean that by talking about or having that conversation that people are going to feel negative about people who are white or vice versa, but just, you know, how do we talk through this history? Because it's important, it's relevant. But I think, you know, we have to feel comfortable having the conversations. What I find here in South Dakota, which I have to say has been a wonderful, wonderful experience for myself and my family, is that I see the whole notion of talking about culture in the same way I see parents that say, well, if I don't talk to my children about sex, then they won't have sex. So if we don't talk about these different cultural elements that we are experiencing in our community, then we don't have a problem dealing with cultural insensitivities that happen. And as I've kind of spent my year in the state, I've seen some things that are kind of, you know, it doesn't really reflect the nature of the state, because I don't think the nature of the state is racist from where I sit so far. But I do think there are some things about addressing culture in a way that we all need to feel comfortable about. And when we take that to the classroom, how do we feel comfortable having those conversations with those students in the classroom that can help them feel like they are a part of South Dakota? They are a part of the classroom and they are meaningful just like everyone else.
I'm surprised when you talk about cultures to have the culture of poverty on that list. That I wouldn't have expected that.
Sure.
When I think of culture, I think of something we celebrate and honor and
exactly.
learn about.
Exactly.
We don't celebrate and honor poverty.
Exactly.
How is poverty a culture?
So, and that's the thing when we think about culture is a way of life. Uh-huh. It's an environment in which we live, an environment in which we identify with either voluntarily or involuntarily. People don't voluntarily suggest that I'm in a culture of poverty. Mm-hmm. But we do have some similar elements of poverty that really impact students and impact students in the classroom. And within that, there is a culture. There are commonalities within that culture that we can look to and address to kind of say, okay, here are things that we need to put into the classroom to make sure that this group of students don't feel isolated. They don't feel uncomfortable in the classroom. Culture of women. But there are nature of women that is a culture. There are things that women together value that are meaningful within their culture. And then there's a culture of, you know, women who are married versus women who are not. And the conversations are different and combinations are similar.
And it's a good time to remind us it's not cultural competence. You don't have to understand everything
about
all those different things.
Exactly.
You just have to be somewhat responsive
right.
to that. When does it fall in and when do you risk stereotypes? So I think if I'm a female teacher and I've got a classroom of rowdy boys, when do I start looking at the culture of being male versus stereotyping boys into one little category?
And I think that's an excellent point. If we think about culturally competent, we get to the point where, oh, we have to understand exactly how boys X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily. But in the responsiveness of the classroom, there's a level of, okay, you know, the class is getting out of control. How do I bring them back in? Physically, boys tend to be more active. So how do I kind of engage in a way that I can bring them back? But we don't want to get to the point where we think this is only boys, and then we do have some females in the classroom that might be physical learners as well, and then say, okay, because I only see this as something boys do, if this female does it, there's something wrong with this female, or it's something out of control with this female. No, she could have grown up with brothers, she could have friends that are boys, or whatever the case may be, but we want to step back and say, okay, what's happening in this classroom, and how do we bring this back to a place of being? Mm-hmm. So rather than saying only the boys go out for recess and get the energy out, you know, how do we all go out? And so, you know, I think that's a good point. We have to make sure that we don't fall into those stereotypes, that those that are not engaged in that might see something different. I'll give you another example. Sorry to my Texas friends. I grew up in Texas. My youngest son was in school, and at recess, he was never one of those physical boys that liked doing physical activities. And the teachers would always say to him at recess, go and play with the boys, go out and do those things. And it really made him feel uncomfortable, to the sense that he would just sit at the wall until recess was over with, because he didn't really engage in those kind of games that the boys played. Mm-hmm. It was very physical, very aggressive, and that's just not his nature. And so that caused him to kind of feel more isolated than to feel more a part of that. So your point is that, yeah, we can't get to that point that we stereotype. We have to look at these students at an individual level and then as a group level.
Right, but understand the role that culture can play.
Oh, and send the role that culture can play.
Let's talk about some specific sort of key, a positive thing of how it looks, sort of the key elements of a culturally responsive teaching classroom.
Sure.
One of the things that I'm looking at an article by Geneva Gay here that you sent me, and some of them were about the locus of control being on the learner and not the teacher. Explain to me what locus of control is and how it's developed in a classroom.
Sure. And I think, you know, when you think about that, it's just a matter of as you see students interacting and engaging in a classroom, you know, you as a teacher or you as the person kind of responding, how do you really kind of help students understand how to engage and get in control in an environment in which there's a level of responsibility for all of us, for the teacher, for the student, et cetera. And how do you help them understand a level of responsibility as you engage and as you move forward? And the same with the teacher as well. How do I accept responsibility rather than saying, you know, that's something I can't talk about or deal with because it's not something that fits within my milieu or my comfortableness? How do I establish that?
Sure. And another one I thought was really interesting was the sort of intentional empathy of putting yourself in situations where you're not dominant and seeing how you feel.
Right.
So
right.
This would be an example of a male teacher going to a staff meeting with all the females.
Exactly.
And how does he feel? Does he feel like he can speak up?
Exactly.
That sort of thing. That was an interesting thing, sort of putting yourself in that situation.
Right. And I had firsthand experience of that. I was an elementary school teacher, being the only male in the school with all females. And it was, for me, a very interesting thing because I am male. And going into that environment, just some of the ways in which they responded to children were different than the way I respond. And it wasn't, you know, they were right or wrong. It was just a different approach. I was much more open and lenient than they were. But with that, I had to find out how to get more in control than they had. But those things kind of come up to play that, you know, you really have to kind of step back and think about that. And I think, you know, not to get into stereotypes, but I have three boys. And one of the things that I really try to work with them on understanding is this notion of emotion. That in our society, we tend to not tell boys to kind of deal with and talk about emotions. But I want them to kind of think about, you know, how did that make you feel? How do you think that made the other person feel when these type of interactions happened? It's because I really want them to have that empathy and understanding of other people. And it doesn't mean that you can't be male. It's just we need to be able to engage in that way. And the same thing as we're in the classrooms, as things happen, how do we have those conversations to help people understand how to connect and respond to one another?
What's the benefit for the kids in the classroom who might all, you know, if the classroom is a majority of white students, what's the benefit to the white students for culturally responsive teaching when they have maybe two Native American students in there? How do the white kids benefit as well?
Exactly. And interesting, when I was in Seattle, when I lived in Seattle, I would go out and visit classrooms, and many of the classrooms were predominantly white. And walking into the classroom and seeing their interaction even with me was kind of interesting, that they didn't really, you know, step back and say, oh, here's a new person, here's an African-American, et cetera, but that I became a part of the classroom. And so as I talked to the teachers about, you know, what was that about? It's because they talk about cultural differences a lot in the classroom on a weekly basis. There's this one time where they really talk about and engage in a level that is not about celebration, but it's about interactions of people.
And they take that forward into adulthood.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think when you are open to have those conversations with students about just who are in our who's in our world and what goes on in our world, those students tend to not build their own stereotypes. Try to make sense of them on their own, but they can have a collective conversation about what this means or what this is about. I think we teach children to be culturally insensitive, not intentionally, but by our actions and the way we respond. And by helping students to really engage in a way, I think it opens up an opportunity as they see people that might be different, whether it's poverty or whatever, they can be more welcoming and understanding and engaging and not look at another person like, well, you are not.
What's a microaggression? I've heard that term a lot sort of being thrown around lately with some controversy. Explain to me what exactly that is.
Right. And so I think when you think about microaggression, it's one of those concepts in which we only have 20 minutes, right?
So we're almost out of time. We have to come back and talk about microaggression.
Yeah, but the microaggression, it really is about, there are things that we might say or suggest or systems that we might develop that really are biased in their nature. You might say to me, I have a friend who's African American. I really enjoy being around African Americans. Sure. And then as systems start to develop, you might intentionally or unintentionally start talking about, all right, well, we have to be careful because as we look at these large black male on campus, we have to make sure that they're not intimidating other people. Mm-hmm. And even though you have a sensitivity or are somewhat understanding, you still have these biases that come in that kind of impacts what you might think about this group of people.
Sure.
And so some of those things kind of happen again, maybe unintentionally rather than intentionally. Maybe another example of this, I've been married for 20 years. I've been married to a woman who's very feminist. And there are things that I do understand about being with a strong female. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes I slip into things that are biased about who she is and get ripped. And it's what it is. And it's those kind of things that we have to constantly be aware of ourselves and reflecting on ourselves so that when we do talk and deal with people of different cultures, that we're looking at it from a conscious place. Right. Rather than a subconscious place. But yeah, we can talk about microaggression much
longer. Reflection and reflective writing is a big part of that classroom as well.
Right.
I wish you were going to have to come back.
Okay,
and we're
going to
talk more education stuff. I haven't met you yet, and I'm glad that you're here.
Well, hey, thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate your time. Dr. Donald Easton Brooks is Dean of the School of Education at the University of South Dakota. The culturally responsive teaching workshops are this week in Vermilion. They're at the Al Newhart Center Conference Room on the campus of USD.